aback or welcome for the first time. I'm Glenn Mitchell of the Friends of the Concord Free Public Library, and we're thrilled to have Dan Chiasson read today from his poetry, followed by some interesting questions and from you folks and some intriguing responses from him. We'll have refreshments afterwards, and also I've been asked to remind people that if you're not a member of the Friends, or even if you are, we'd love you to consider becoming a member if you're not. And this is our renewal season, and we've sent out letters reminding people that of all the good things that we do, and hope that you'll continue to support the library through the Friends. What we do is not only support this weekly reading series, weekend reading series, but we have a very dynamic international film series held over at the West Fowler, the West Concord branch in Fowler, and we also have a music series that brings internationally known musicians, and we have a number of other things that we help to sponsor. But I wanted to tell you a few things first about our poet today, Dan Chiasson. Some of you know him, others of you are going to get to know him a lot better this afternoon. But Dan was born in Burlington, Vermont. He was educated at Amherst College and Harvard, where he received his PhD in English, and he's now teaching at Wellesley College. Dan is the author of three collections of poetry. Can you hear me back there?
Yep.
Can you hear me fine?
Okay.
His three collections of poetry include The Afterlife of Objects, Natural History, and Where's the Moon, There's the Moon, as well as a book of criticism, One Kind of Everything, Poem and Person in Contemporary America. Dan is widely published and a respected poetry critic, and since the fall of 2008, as most of you know by now, he is one of the poetry editors of the Paris Review. Dan is a recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, an Academy Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and a Whiting, Whiting Writers Award. Robert Pinsky, in speaking of Afterlife of Objects, said that Dan Chiasson has succeeded in writing the poetry many of his generation aimed for. Free-swinging, gorgeous in phrase, bold in imagination, athletic in movement. What more could you ask for? And from the poet Frank Bidard of the same collection, of the same first collection, has said, Chiasson has developed a way of asking a poem that is intensely inner, personal, even autobiographical, of making a poem, but that is in no sense confessional. John Ashbery has also spoken up about the fine work that he produces and has said, like Emerson's transparent eyeball, Chiasson's gaze is curious, friendly, and unassumingly all-encompassing. Like William James, another mentor, his distinctions are smooth and profound and capable of sudden crescendos of meaning that are heartbreaking in their intensity. Dan has been called a poet of great grief and love, and further, that in his third book, Where a Child's Improvised Game of Where's the Moon, There's the Moon, is a shaping metaphor. His voice is more commanding than ever, embracing the notion of how small, yet how rich and significant, are our individual stories in time and space. Let's welcome Dan Chiasson.
Thanks. Can you hear me okay? Thanks, Glenn. Thanks to everyone for coming. Are you sure this is where you want to be? It's awfully nice outside. Sure. All set?
No, try that.
Okay, how's that? Good? Great.
Is that better?
Can you hear me? Okay, can you hear me? No, not so good?
Not good.
Tilt the mic up.
Up? Better?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thanks. Great to be here. Nice to be able to get over to Concord in less than 3 hours, suddenly. Some friends of mine are here from near our house, and we live along the Sudbury River on a road called Water Row, maybe you know it. I was saying to them today that I saw a fish run over by a car in the middle of the road. Amazing. First time I'd seen fish roadkill in my life. And it shouldn't be funny, but somehow it was funny. I'm going to read totally from my new book, which is called Where's the Moon, There's the Moon. I'll tell you where I got the title. Our older son, Louis, is about 5 and a half now. When he was about 2, he would run around his room at night before bed, looking out the window, looking for the moon, saying, "Where's the moon? Where's the moon? Where's the moon?" And when we'd find it, he would say, "There's the moon." But at that point, he would get very depressed seeming. Why? Because the game was over. And at that point, he invented this brilliant strategy, which was to put his hands over his eyes and say, "Where's the moon? Where's the moon?" And then take them away and say, "There's the moon." In the sort of intuitive way that such things take shape, I knew right away that that was the title of my next book, even though I'd only written maybe a quarter of the poems in the book. And how would I explain the appeal of that notion? I think that T.S. Eliot says somewhere that poetry is a form of punctuation, which is, though a very modest claim for poetry, seems to me to be about as profound a thing as has ever been said about poetry. Why? Because, like this little game that my son Louis invented, it's a way of taking a kind of block, a blob of time, and dividing it up into little episodes that have meaning, in fact. So whether it's a game of hide and seek, which suddenly takes time and turns it into a game where you go and try to find something, or you try to hide from something, or as in poetry, where so often what a poet is doing is playing a little game with you where he or she is concealing meaning, and then partly revealing meaning, and then going back into concealing it, and then partly revealing it. That's what I look for, actually, in poems that I love, and what I try to do in poems that I write, which is to have there be some incentive for a reader to come looking for me. It can't be too easy, and it also can't be too difficult. So that's the origin of the title. I'm going to read the first poem in the book. I wrote this poem actually right after I published my second book, and I hadn't written any new poems. And the main emotion I was feeling was wondering what kind of poem I would be able to write next. And turns out that's actually a very good subject for poetry, wondering what will be next. And so this poem is spoken, you can hear it as, if you like, is spoken by a person, but I actually intended it to be spoken by the poem itself, kind of wondering what's going to come along and fill it up. Here follows an account of the nature of birds. Here follows an account of the nature of fish. Here follows a description of an unknown town. Here follows the phoenix flight from human eyes. Here follow the friendship fish and langoust. All the marvels of erotic danger follow here. Here follows the phone number of a dead person. Here follows a game based on perfect information. Here follows the address of a place to buy cocaine. Big sadness come your way, sunrise, skyline. Let's do it some new way next time we try. Do you have anything you can put inside me? Here follows an account of the nature of birds. Aquarium. I am full of secrets, but none of them is yours. You can't confide in the outside world. The surface of the glass is your only conceivable body. These traces of movement, sudden shadows, they're not fish. There are varieties of life unknown to you. Their whole identity is, you can't find out. You can't find out, however hard you try, no matter what you say, however advanced you are. They swim away, these things that are not fish. Look at those bodies on the street. Do you see how beautifully designed the human body is? How can you compare your column for containing water? My mind contains everything except for fish. The rumor of depth is your new atmosphere. You can't confide in me. I'm not an aquarium. Now, this poem is called Mosaic of a Hair, Corinium, 100 AD. One way to write poems for me is to take two ideas that have nothing to do with one another, or two images that have nothing to do with one another, and just very simply try to get them talking to each other, get them in dialogue in some way, or try to make them mesh in some way. And this is one such poem. There were two things. One was a documentary, I think, on the History Channel. Some tired night after we put our kids to bed, about the bombing of Wall Street in the 20s, which was a kind of precursor to 9/11, or so was the argument of this film was. And the other was a little image I saw of a floor mosaic, a Roman floor mosaic of a hare, H-A-R-E, which was uncovered in a basilica in Rome. And it was an image of this hare about to eat a sprig of clover. And I was very touched by this, because here was a 2,000 years old picture of somebody about to eat something, just frozen at that moment of their appetite about to be satisfied. So I actually don't really know how those two things finally go together, but my idea was to try to put them together and write this poem. Mosaic of a Hare, Corinium, 100 AD. The boats pulling in, the boats pulling out, the top hat commerce of the infant century. Crowds, crowds, the certainty of others, the bomb that filled the air with horsehair and the ambulance after. Why wouldn't I hide in my little glass body? I have a clover sprig made of glass to aspire to with my glass appetite. I raise certain questions about art and its relation to stasis, yet I despise the formalists as naive and ahistorical. Here's my problem with America. This would-be that obliterates all other moods, playing over and over in people's heads, the abstract optative that destiny works out. I don't have the luxury to think in terms of destiny. What nobody seems to get about me is, though you're made of glass, it doesn't mean you don't have appetites. I do. Or fears. I do. The day the darkness took the whole basilica, I was afraid. And equally afraid the day centuries later they switched the lights on. Let rabbits think in terms of destiny. Whitman, the great American rabbit poet. The rabbits in the government. The rabbits that light and the ones that snuff out the fuse. And all their pretty rabbit children waiting to be casserole. This is a sequence of poems called Swifts, and I named it that for two reasons. The first is we were at the Harvard Museum of Natural History, where they have all the stuffed beasts, and I saw some stuffed swifts and learned that, I hope I'm right about this, I never feel very confident in my bird knowledge, but I learned, I think, that swifts sleep on the wing. They sleep while flying. So that was one idea. And the second idea was, I wrote these, I think, 10 poems all in one night. And the first time this ever happened to me, while I was writing one, I could actually imagine the next one and the one after that. And so there's this curious feeling of, while I was writing one, wanting to get it done with as quickly as possible, because I was afraid I would forget the next one and the one after it. So they're called swifts simply because they had to be very, very rapid, otherwise I would forget the one that I hadn't yet written, if that makes sense. I don't know how much you like to hear authors talk about their poems. It can be sort of okay. Well, I'll tell you that the poem, the sequence starts with a poem called Fist, and it ends with a poem called Caress. And the thinking in the sequence of the poem was that when you feel suddenly that you want to write a poem, it's as though you've made a fist. And exactly like making a fist, suddenly you feel as though you only have one purpose. You can't make language do anything else until you unclench the fist or punch somebody or do something to alleviate this tension of making this fist. So it turns out that that night, what I felt like was that I had, in fact, made a fist and had to do something with it and was going to be in big trouble if I didn't find some way of using it. And then by the end of the poem, the way I think about it is I've unclenched the fist and am able to use my hand again for the range of things you need to do with a hand. So that's the kind of arc of this sequence. Swift's one fist. It is impossible for me to remember the cozy room I slept in as a child. Somebody made my bed up to be paradise. It was hard for me, a hard night when I entered art. The tendons in my wrist are visible. What will I do now I have made this fist? To loosen it feels weird, anticlimactic. A misuse, a misunderstanding of fists. That's how it was with me that night, and so mysteriously I lost my sweetness. Weird to feel intended for violence when what I wanted was an hour of rest. To thread. I should say one reason I was able to accelerate so quickly through my imagination of these poems is that I knew very early in writing them that they were going to work by counterpoint. So I knew as soon as I wrote a poem called Thread, there was going to be have to be one called Needle or something like that. And as soon as I wrote one called Cause, there was going to be one called Effect. And it was hard just to stay imaginatively segregated in the one I was writing when it was totally possible to imagine its counterpoint. So, to thread. I lack the rigor of a lightning bolt, the weight of an anchor. I am frayed where it would be highly useful, and this I feel perpetually to make a point. I think if I can concentrate, I might turn sharp. Only I don't know how to concentrate. I know the look of someone concentrating, indistinguishable from nearsightedness. It is hard for the others to be near me, my silly intensity shuffling a zillion insignia of interiority. Being near me never made anyone a needle. Three, wind. Find some other reason to sway, forest. Old people get bent over from vitamin deficiencies. Trees take them as your inspiration. For I have neither time nor energy any longer to write poems, to make feeling out of what without me is silent. I find you're standing there disgusting. And you, reader, I see you nod your head, tree-like, appraising these lines. I find you're standing there, not disgusting, but not inspiring either. That's rather a nasty thing to say to readers, isn't it? Four, but you have to remember that after you've finished a poem, you are its reader. Even its author is its reader. And so that level of self-disgust, it need not extend out to anyone other than the author. Four, tree. All day I wanted to be blown, then someone cut me down. I have instead of thoughts, uses. Uses instead of feelings. One day I'll feel the wind again. A moment later I'll be gone. Five, cause. Whitman wrote this before he started writing poetry. He was a journalist for years, you know, a radical, a partisan for some ridiculous cause. He wrote this to support, or was it to condemn, a cause? It doesn't matter if you aren't Whitman yet. Now that he's been Whitman for so long, it would. Six, effect. Everything scatters as the night wears on, but you don't scatter, will you? I think we could make this night last forever. With our joined heads, like mathematicians, we could work all night, so that where night once was, work would be, and night, as long as work went on, would never end. It is starting to sound a little tiring, all this working, just to stave off morning. 7. Needle's Eye. I wish I were as big as a basketball hoop. It is actually painful to be this fine. It is like squinting for no reason all night, choosing the pain of squinting over going to sleep. And yet, what does it matter how big a target you are? Someone, somewhere, will invent a game to make you hard to hit. 8. Sound, 2 a.m. A minute ago, I was a child coughing, having had too much of everything today except for air. Now I'm an animal, feeling tonight perplexed. I fled the outside, the cold, the lack of food. I meant to enter a house, which I connect with warmth, which my body told me was the appropriate move. Instead, I entered a person's mind. Like the child, I am trapped. I have no will, no life to call my own. 9. Swifts. Reality isn't one point in space. It isn't one moment in time. Look at time, a spool of twine one minute, idle in a sewing kit, the next minute a shooting star. Reality is an average of moods. Strike that, a flock of birds. Strike that, a single bird tracked through dense forest. You can lose it for hours or days, but it isn't lost. You tired of the metaphor? 10. Caress. The tendons flattened and the knot untied. You could do anything then with your hand. You could forget the fact you had a hand. This lasted, or so you were tempted to think, for years. Winter didn't matter, yet spring arrived as a blessing to your body. Sweetness, or what passed for it, returned. And then, like an anchor yanked suddenly from the sea, your muscles clenched. There are a few poems about trains in this book. When I got into writing it, I realized that it was going to be, in a way that probably doesn't matter to anybody except for me, plotted on a vertical axis so that there was going to be a moon, there would be satellites in it, there would be birds, and to complete the vertical axis, I needed the thing that runs closest to the Earth, which is trains. It seems to actually hug the surface of the Earth. So that little intellectual idea sponsored some attempts to write about trains. This poem is called Man and Derailment, and it actually there's a story behind it. When I was a kid, growing up outside of Burlington, Vermont, I didn't know my father, so I'd become very close to my friends' fathers, whoever and whatever they were. My one friend Ryan had a very weird kind of father. He listened to his police scanner all day long, which was not that uncommon where I grew up, actually. Anyway, over the scanner came news that there had been this derailment of a train. Turned out to be a terrible accident. 9, 10, 11, something like that, people died. It was on the front page of the New York Times at the time. And his idea was that we would all hop into a car and drive out to the place in the woods and bushwhack down the banks to see where the derailment was, which we did. I can report to you that it was quite awful to see. But also that what I was feeling at the time was very simply, how amazing to have a father. This is so great. Later, after this poem was published, I got a letter in the mail from somebody in North Carolina. The poem doesn't mention any places or details at all about the crash. I got a letter from somebody who was living in North Carolina saying, was that the Amtrak derailment outside of Essex Junction, Vermont in 1983? Which, I mean, no irony, actually is the most gratifying response I've ever had to a poem. Man and Derailment. When the man took his son down the ravine to view along the opposite bank the pileup of a passenger train, backhoes, and cranes, things the child had seen only in miniature, now huge, hauling life-size train cars out of the deep ravine. Inside his life-size head, the quiet boy wondered how he would remember the scene. And once he knew his father better later, and later knew himself better, what it would mean. Here's a sequence called Satellites, short little poems. Satellites, one, Banquette. The satellite that crisscrossed the sky one day encountered gravity. The moment it hit the water, it was in a different documentary. So why would I give it a thought what you do all night in your apartment when you're mine on the street and mine now in this suede Banquette? Two, Bullet. What counts as a target and what does not is not innate or inevitable. One minute your eye falls limply like a net. The next it becomes a bullet. What counts as a bullet follows the same rule. Inert, a lump of something small, chalky in the palm of your hand, finds its fate, it has a fate, when it gets shot. Three, Night Scene. Meanwhile, standing by, the stars. A field where the moon shines. Clouds suddenly darken the field. If nothingness were a rug, we'd buy it. Houses go uncharted week after week. Whole lifetimes happen on schedule. A child arrives without incident, grows up to be an astronaut, I mean assassin. Four, Orbit. You have this big capacity, small speck, barely there at all until the sun detects your metal shell, then only a pinprick. And yet you can predict the moment, having already lived it, lived through it, laughed it off. We thought our child would suffer forever. Five, Next. If you can orbit the planet, why can't you see what makes the human heart happy? Is it art or is it sex? Or is it, as I suspect, just keeping going? From next thing to next thing, to next thing, to next thing, to next, to next, to next, to next. Pulsating stupidly to outlast time. Eight. Abstruser musings. To be no one at all, merely the latest to have had his brain turned inside out by vanity, so that it shine entirely upon itself. Is this what M.H. Abrams called the lamp? I call it masturbation, not as an insult, but an accurate name. It feels good doing it, and people like to watch. Nine, Blake. A satellite sees into your heart. It is blind to the rest of the planet. Its giant eye stares all day at the one bullseye on its one target. It sees that your heart is sick. You're sick. All that it sees is the fact your heart that once held endless joy, now sick, soon will thy life destroy. Train. Since we're local, I'll tell you. Before we lived in Sudbury, we lived in Sherburn, which nice town, but we didn't like how close our house was to the road anyway. And we're both insomniacs, and the last thing you want to know is what time it is. But you couldn't ever ignore it because you could tell by the traffic on the road exactly what time it was, A. And then B, there was a train that would go by at regular intervals, so you could tell exactly that 3 hours had passed since the last. Anyway, so we out of there. And train. You there in the middle of your mind, curled up into a ball, curled up into a ball, but wide awake. I am awake like you in the same bed, hearing the train that when it passes means it's almost morning, though the sky is dark, though the highway is quiet. You can follow the train in your mind, but your mind cannot follow the train from little town to Boston, where in the dark the transactions happen. Something is poured, something is filled, something is dropped off, something is taken. Happen among the loud men at the wharf before their very first sign of dawn, and the train in Boston turns around. I wish our minds were like the train, passing once a night through the woods, fading out among the lights and termini, its load of oil or metal going someplace they want it, returning in the morning, its mile-long belly not empty, not hungry. Not the wharf accepting train after train of junk from the provinces all night, a throat that tries to swallow dirt. I have a longish poem at the center of this book, 27 sections long. I have read it all in the past, but I also have read just the first movement, which I'm going to do that today, only because, I don't know, I think you get a sense of it from these first few sections, and also it allows me to read some poems that come after it, which I, in some ways, I don't know, like better. Is that okay? Anyway, but the poem is called Where's the Moon, There's the Moon, A Story for Children. It's the title poem of the book. I actually had tried to do it as a children's story. When I had the idea of this poem, I had it sort of as a narrative, not as a poem jumping all around, and sat down to try to write it out as a children's story, and actually even contacted an agent. But there was something very discouraging about, it seemed to me, the kind of market for children's stories. I was immediately asked whether it was going to be for 4-year-olds, 7-year-olds, 11-year-olds, and my mind just fogged up at that moment. I had no idea. And there were certain kind of consequences to deciding that it was for a 4-year-old rather than a 7-year-old that weren't at all self-evident to me. And then you had to think about, was it going to be, were there going to be illustrations? And if so, do you draw? I don't. So I just fogged up totally and decided to write it as a poem. Much easier to do that. One. If I look to the opposite shore and greet myself there, if I call out to myself, come here, and watch myself laboriously construct from shore things a boat, and watch myself over the waters come rowing, but crossing the midpoint between shores, out in the middle of the colorless lake, no longer approaching, no longer coming closer, disappear. Where am I now? Has my boat capsized? Two. Infinite capacity for love in the smallest detail. Infinite suffering in the innermost reality. Large mind in even the dumbest, mutest object. Destiny in an object that stands still. Heart in the middle of the gray, motionless water. The largest sadness in the world in a groaning buoy. In a buoy and the bird overhead, huge sadness. And yet I hop from place to place as though I'm weightless. Three. When I picture my father, I see the surface of the moon. Plains of moon stuff, chalk dust, paper shredded by a paper shredder, snowbanks of shredded paper, nobody to organize it all, no way to, quote, moralize the day out of its aimlessness, nobody with a shop vac handy, slowly to turn the whiteness into pattern and form, revealing, as a chisel reveals in the marble, a figure, a woman's figure, an expression of bliss. Four. Now that big non-entity, the moon, is in my mind, the cliches for representing Earth are hereby banished. 100 open-ended poems, abrupt transitions, high tones grating against the low, unsorted experience, sex beside the holy man defiled by sex, the pig pile of ways you can get high, right there beside the dawn and how you badly want to kill yourself, the fleer. The road that unravels like a banner before him. 5. And the child's attention fixed upon the animal book, and all the animals in the book intent upon dinner, or eyeing some harbinger cloud forever, permanently dejected because some little stone turned their child to stone, weeping big mule or owl tears, as though the child never turned the page, the sun never shone again, bringing larkspurs, gentian, and the mule boy reunited with mule mommy and daddy just in time to end. 6. But the mule on page 4 will always be sad. The owl overhead will always mourn for the mule in his sadness. Nobody will ever bring news of page 11 when mule boy returns from the dead. And the child reading the book will always preside like a sinister god over these animals, always dipping in and out of their moods like a snacker. A little sadness to tide you over until supper time. A little elegiac owl. Some time at the grief picnic. 7. He has lived on the moon for now 30 years, part of an old guild, virtually a decoration. But I am proud of him, as was his master keeper proud of him, this noble, endless line of moon keepers who hang the light that lights the moon and take it down every morning, meaning that it is morning, get up. That's not a pie plate over there in the east. Sleepyheads, lovers, climb down off your beloveds. 8. As the child is to the book, a watcher, a dabbler, so he is, I think, to my own life, that he may know or not his being in the sky in a position that looked at in a certain light affords omniscience, but looked at in another light is blindness pure. But since he lights and snuffs the lantern on the moon, I have the illusion of his being nearby, not in the photonegative of life, snowbanks and cold. 9. No flowers ever, hardly a bird, nobody to say to you, want a lick of this? Or here, I have an extra one. Or you can take more and nothing bad will happen. Or I like it a little more than that. Or send me, won't you, one of your new poems? I'd like to have that. And never the whispered request, there, that's it. Right there. And so why would I go to the anti-Earth? Not that he asked, but if he did, why would I ever go? Stay with him on that windswept sand planet. A house here, a house there, no tree, no sod, nothing not buried in sand. A few moon plums and moon peas, the city people gather and preserve in ceramic jars, and schooners come from Boston to gather the sand from masonry suppliers back in the city, but sand sweeps in and fills the deep furrows their shovels leave, and the ugly moon jays buzz above like houseflies. The last section of this book is called Hide and Seek. It's some poems about the theme of the book, in a way, ways that you divide time into little suspenseful intervals, ways that you can attract somebody by being either in poems or in person by being a little mysterious, the power you have over a person by suddenly being clear with them, the wish that children have, and I think later grown-up children have, the wish to find some way to sort of occupy themselves, amuse themselves in ways that aren't totally self-destructive. So it's called Hide and Seek, and it's got a number of little parables about hiding and seeking. It's got some references in it. The first poem is called Herbarium. And the one I have, an herbarium is, you know, a little book full of pressed flowers. It was a popular pastime with girls some years ago that they would take and press flowers and then write little inscriptions underneath them. The most famous such book is Emily Dickinson's. And for years, I knew about it only by rumor. I knew that it was in the Houghton Library at Harvard, but that it was so delicate that it just couldn't be touched. And if you go to the Rare Books Library at Harvard, you can touch practically anything there. You can go hold John Milton's, or John Keats's edition of John Milton in your hands. So it was amazing. There was something in that library that you just simply could not touch. Oddly, it's now available in facsimile, so somebody must have touched it, and it's entirely too touchable now. But anyway, that's actually part of the reason I wrote these poems about this book, which one minute is just some rumor of something so delicate and fragile and unique that it can't even be touched. And the next minute, it's there in mass production, in facsimile, available to be purchased but from Harvard University Press. That's the herbarium plot of these poems. Herbarium. Jasmine means passion, and privet means private. If they are bound together in a book hidden underground, a famous book, off limits in a library, which one wins? Privet that kept the secret, or jasmine that made the privet shine? Stadium. An empty stadium is an indrawn breath. There hasn't been a team here in ages. Futuristic is starting to look very old. It's a vast cereal bowl, and in it, bobbing like a raisin, there's my childhood. I'm rooting for the non-existent team. Waterfall. Meanwhile, like a treadmill, a waterfall pours its entire body downstream, going nowhere. Pours and is filled by the nothing waters upstream, as though gravity needed something to gloat about. Hide and seek. Once, north of here, a child played hide and seek. His part was to hide, ergo, he played his role and hid. The seeker, embarrassed by his role, thinking it beneath his dignity, developed instead a personality disorder. Herbarium 2. Once, west of here, a child fastened flowers to the pages of a book and wrote their names in Latin underneath. This was the pinnacle of mimesis. The flowers are so brittle now, nobody is allowed to open that book. Olympic Stadium, Montreal. There is no name for the tendency of things to start to fall apart before they are complete, but that isn't because the phenomenon is rare. To the contrary, little poem, this is the common condition. Falls, Bristol, Vermont. The waterfall runs all day and night, shedding big self on the rocks below, refilling with more self, more self, more self, while bathers visit in small groups, never the same bathers, always the same river, my local inverted redneck pre-Socratic. Revolving door. I spit and swallow with equal gusto. Spitting is not a sign of disgust. Swallowing is not a sign of hunger. Casting out is not a sign of anger. Allowing in is not affection. I chug along, doing what I meant to do. Hide and seek, two. Hide and seek, hide and seek, the magic trick of keeping time in play by yo-yo mini episodes of loss and recovery. One day that game goes dark, and you want a new game whose object isn't loss. The rule is, everyone stay close by in sight. Previews. It was the newest movie, and we arrived early. Something bright and loud was playing. Not the movie, but not that different from the movie. Infinitely elongated beforehand, bright, not yet. Our children grew impatient in your zone. We left the movie before the movie began. Thanks. Thanks. Thanks a lot. So I'm happy to answer questions. Love to answer questions. About anything. Not anything, but Don?
So when the book takes a title, does that form the poems that come afterwards, or does it leave some out? discriminate?
Absolutely, all of those things. I should say, when I saw Louis doing that, I knew it was a title for something, maybe not a book. And I had written some poems that suddenly were ruled in by the presence of this title, potentially of a book, and others that were ruled out. And then the key was, first of all, well, so many things. I didn't want it to be such a conscious intention to write towards this title that I would freeze up my imagination, which does tend to thrive given a little latitude, I think. And so I was conscious of not intentionally writing towards it, but I think it functioned as a kind of conscience or monitor, you know, keeping me on track.
So did the hide and seek poems come after?
That's a good question. Yeah, actually, I'd written the entire book and titled it, and actually gotten back in the mail galleys. I'd seen proofs of the book was essentially published, all but for my little emendations. And when I got it, it seemed incomplete. There were two sections. Things with two sections often aren't quite right. You want a third. So there was just some mathematical instability to it. And also, the meanings of the book were like really clear to me. And so I wrote those last poems really last and very, very, very late, so late that I had to kind of like stop the presses and tell them to slip in these last little poems. And it was a very gratifying experience to do that. It was as though I had put a child out into the world and then got to take it back and redo it a little bit and rewire it and then put it back out, you know, which is something you obviously don't get to do. So, and if it's anything, I think this book is, if it's good at all, it's good because of those last few poems. So that's why I try to read them. This is my opinion, you know. Oh yeah, yes, Kathy asks. The long title poem is definitely indebted to Harold and the Purple Crayon, but also Sylvester and the Magic Pebble. These are great children's books. You know, Sylvester and the Magic Pebble is a story of it's a donkey. I changed it to a mule. Aren't poets brilliant? Genius. I stole somebody's idea, just changed the animal. Anyway, it's a donkey in that book, and a little donkey boy goes off walking, and he finds this little pebble, and it can grant him any wish. He, after an initial period of some novelty, he encounters a lion out in the fields. The lion scares him and he panics, and rather than wishing that the lion disappear or something, he wishes that he would become a stone. And he then becomes this big boulder. The little pebble drops beside him. It turns out that in order for the pebble to work, you have to be holding it in your hands. He no longer has hands. And this, but the amazing thing to me was that this all happens in the first, say, three or four pages of the book. And then there are like 20 pages of maybe a 30-page total length book where his parents, really, they grieve. You know, winter turns to spring. They sort of move on. I mean, you're living, it's incredible the percentage of this book where you're living in their grief. And I thought that was very bold and profound on William Steig's part, because many children's book authors would want to let the child off the hook right away, you know. The child would, you know, the donkey would turn to a stone on page 4, and then on page 6 all would be well. But in this book, you really inhabit the awful grief of the parents, and then at the end, all is restored. So that, yeah.
Yeah, I think I only read that stuff about
900.
900? Four times to my book.
It's a great book.
I want to ask you,
yes.
In terms of putting the book together,
yeah.
Do you, does it really matter to like read from start to finish? Do you have a structure that way, or can you just open it up and start?
I think you can just open it up and start it at any point. I would think that, just for me, when I encounter a book, I would tend to think that sequences are better read from beginning to end. Not that you can't find poems within them that you like best and read over and over and over again, or commit to memory or whatever. So I would think that sequences of poems are better read the way you would read a novel or a story from beginning to end. But I try not to be too persnickety about ordering books to tell some story, and the poems would be totally gibberish if, you know, if read out of order. One of the advantages of poetry is that you don't have to read it in order. But other poets would answer that question profoundly differently, it seems to me. Yes?
Can we talk for a minute about being critical?
Sure.
Given books to review, or do you say, well, I want to review the new John
Ashton? Used to be I was given books to review, and the effect of that was that I would write many, many more negative reviews than I actually, as a rather mild-mannered person, wanted to do. But I didn't have any choice, because I was given 10 books, and what's the likelihood that all 10 are going to be good? And I didn't have any say in choosing, well, no, I would only like to do these 5. And I was committed to being candid and thought, well, there's nothing to lose. So I wrote some negative reviews then. Now, since I've sort of made a name or whatever, I try to only accept books that I can say something. Except in rare cases where somebody's reputation has been inflated in my view, or there's some really awful influence of this person in the world, and I feel that I can do something to moderate that influence, I usually only take books that I can write positively about. I think a lot of that has to do with the genre of poetry, where, you know, if Anthony Lane is writing a movie review every week, or David Denby every week, you know, the New Yorker has a commitment to reviewing 2 movies a week, week in and week out, and it doesn't do the art of movies any damage to have some negative reviews in there. Whereas if the New Yorker publishes, say, 3 or 4 reviews of a living poet in a year, I think it would do some damage to poetry to have those reviews be negative. So that's what I've been doing lately. I don't know, beside that, I try to pick books that I will have to do some research on, because it's the way I keep myself educated. I mean, I don't go and audit classes, or not a lot of information comes in. It's not a lot of time in my day to just take up an interest. So I know that if I choose to write about the Alexandrian poet Cavafy, and I know nothing about him, I'm going to have to learn a lot about Cavafy, a lot about Alexandria, a lot about Greek poetry, and so I try to pick things that will kind of benefit me, so that's the principle. Yes.
Can you talk about the balance between mystery and clarity?
Yeah.
How do you? You know what you have in your head,
right,
what you're trying to say.
Yes.
How many clues do you give the reader, and how do you decide,
right,
when the poem is getting too explanatory?
Yeah.
Or that whole...
Great question. Amazing. Thank you. It's totally intuitive is the short answer, but not to be too mystifying, but what I would say on behalf or in defense of mystery or difficulty in poetry is that, I tell this to my students, the poem has to be interesting enough that its reader wants to read it many, many, many times, but it can't be so clear that once it's read once, it's totally clear, and the reader moves on to the next poem. So there has to be some enticement to keep the reader reading. It can't be so amazingly difficult and impenetrable and random that you just go forget it, or so clear that you go forget it. So, and what do you do once you've enticed a reader who may not understand the poem, or even understand that much of the poem? Then you have a kind of opportunity to deliver some other kind of pleasure or comfort that doesn't have to do with comprehension. That's where the beauty of the language might get felt. That's where some clarity in the images might be apprehended. In other words, all the stuff in language that doesn't depend on just giving information, here's how to get to Route 2, you know, or here's the best place to eat in town. All those other functions for language depend on you not getting the information you want out of the poem right away. So I don't know if that's a kind of too philosophical answer, but I try to have there be enough to entice the reader to stay involved with the poem and not just move on to the next thing right away. Maybe I want the poem to be read 20 times, I don't know. And then once you've decided, well, that's the argument for mystification or for difficulty, then often you do want to kind of punctuate a poem with a moment of real clarity or real statement or something that is you intend to be arresting or candid or confessional. So that's the way I work this, you know, terrain. Yes?
Would you say a few words about the poem where you borrow
Rosella's
stick?
Oh, yeah. Right. Sure. I was asked if I would say something about the poem where I borrow some lines from Blake, "O Rose, Thou Art Sick." And it's the last poem in this sequence of poems called Satellites. What was I thinking? Well, let's see. That's, first of all, just an incredible poem. I wish I could quote the whole thing. But it's very savage. I mean, Blake has absolutely no sympathy at all for this poor rose. He's kind of condemning it to its sickness. And I had no one person in mind, actually, mercifully, for that one person I didn't have in mind. But I did want to write a poem that condemned a person, an adversary, in the same very harsh terms. And so I knew that I wanted this sequence to end with a poem that was kind of condemning, almost a curse. And I just remembered that Blake was able to do that in that poem so impressively. So I'll read the poem to you. I just called it Blake, and I didn't mean the allusion to be hard to get at all. I put it in quotation marks in the poem, so you would know that it was from somewhere else. Blake, a satellite sees into your heart. It is blind to the rest of the planet. Its giant eye stares all day at the one bullseye on its one target. It sees that your heart is sick. You're sick. All it sees is the fact, your heart that once held endless joy, now sick, soon will thy life destroy. So that's it. I just borrowed from Blake in order to be sort of, I don't know, strike a little tone of terrifyingness. I always loved monster movies and books where curses are made and spells are cast and you can do something awful to a person with a bit of language. And that was what I wanted to do in that poem. So there are some other allusions in that sequence, one from Coleridge to Frost at Midnight. Any other questions?
Any more questions?
Thanks very much. Thank you.
Everyone stay, and good conversation, refreshments.
Indeed.
Book signing.
Yes.
And our final